Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Wednesday, June 25th, 2003. Today's session is HIV/AIDS in Africa, Session 3 of Out of West Africa, presented by Anne and Willie Longji. The number is LAA-2003-03. Let's listen in.
I'm originally from North Dakota, Montana. Have been serving with the Evangelical Lutheran Church of America in Africa now for 8 years, 6 years in the Central African Republic, working with the medical organization of the Lutheran Church of the Central African Republic. And now, for the past 2.5 years, we've been in Senegal, sent by the ELCA. I'm still working in community health there. My training is not medical, it's in community development. So it's using other skills and collaborating with those who are medically trained. So Willie is from Cameroon. Why am I saying that?
Just go ahead.
I know you by now.
You know how to say it.
We've been married 5 years almost. He's from Cameroon and was working there with a non-governmental organization when we met at a training session in Cameroon. Then he came and joined me in the Central African Republic for a couple of years before we were sent to these positions in Senegal. His work presently focuses on assisting and advising a herders cooperative and a youth center or a cultural center. Directing that project. Why are we talking about HIV and AIDS in Africa?
Did you burn your CD?
We said burn it, Tom. I guess Tom's on today, so hope that's set. As we said in the little description about today's conversation, HIV/AIDS is in and out of the news, whether it's concerning the United States or Asia or Africa. I think this year probably Africa has once again gotten quite a bit of press, partially because of good old W's, 15 billion that he has promised to the fight against HIV/AIDS. We can talk about that some too if people want to. Probably some of you might be more aware of what's happening with that than I am. I get information, internet, some stuff in newspapers and things like that, but I'm not real in tune with that. So what we do want to do is today is just share some stories from our experiences. In the Central African Republic, I did work with a project that was called Ganduru Nawasida, which of course I have to translate. That's the Sango language that says, accompany those living with HIV/AIDS. That was a small sort of pilot project of the Central African Lutheran Church. It was supported by funds from the Global Health Ministry. And I think it's grown by leaps and bounds just in the 2.5 years since we left. So that's pretty exciting. I still get correspondence from the Central African nurse who's the project director for that. So there's some really great work going on in response to the pandemic, at least in that part of the world. What we're going to do now, actually, is show you just 5 minutes or so of a video that the Stand With Africa campaign put out about AIDS in Senegal, and it's called Braving AIDS Senegal's Way. Senegal has somehow managed or has just been lucky enough to keep its rate of HIV relatively low compared to the rest of sub-Saharan Africa. And so it's been lifted up oftentimes as a place, that a model of some of the things that can be done to prevent the kind of suffering that we see in some other countries. So I'm just going to show a portion of it because it's a 25-minute video. And I didn't think we wanted to take that much time watching something that we weren't interacting with. So I want to show just those 5 minutes. If maybe either after this session, some of us could stay around and watch the rest of it if you were interested. There's a copy in the Resource Center, and when there's not stuff going on in the Creekside room over here, there are VCRs in there. So that's another option. But I think it'll just sort of start the conversation a little bit. Everybody okay with that?
Yeah.
What do you have to say?
Nothing so far.
So. Oh, the screen.
Jump.
Yeah, I pulled it up so it'd be down low enough that I could pull it. Before, I wasn't able to. Now, is it doing anything? I turned it on.
If the state of Minnesota were the nation of Namibia,
as the volume,
there would be 950,000 Minnesotans living with AIDS.
When a woman can't make any money she can sell herself, she can get AIDS.
All those women there cost $3 each, taxi included. All these young guys are waiting for the prostitutes that are gone but are coming back. And I'm here to give prophylactics in order to protect them.
Barbecue outside, and the sex worker there inside.
Why did they send your chance?
I was an emergency room doctor, and AIDS was a sickness. But when I saw the questions that the young people were asking in school, I understood that we would not win the war against AIDS in the hospital.
AIDS gets into a neighborhood. Wherever they pick up the trail of AIDS, a strategy for saving Senegal begins. Watch for how it works. As Lutherans in America and as people, we have a stake in their success. Africa's day ends here. Its westernmost point is Senegal. The shortest distance between Africa and America runs straight out across this sea. All over Senegal, community groups are out to stop HIV, the virus that causes AIDS. Here in the busy fishing town of Mbour, a group called Dego is out on the street and off to the market, spreading the message about HIV and AIDS. They're volunteers. They get out often, and they use educational materials from a Lutheran World Relief project.
Strategically speaking, the town of Mbour is a target for the AIDS epidemic. It provides fish for one of Senegal's biggest regions, and it's a crossroads town on two main highways. So there are a lot of truckers here, and prostitution is really well developed. And the risk factor that we notice most around here is from the tourist trade.
Since Mbour is a fishing town, we say there are three boats to save people from AIDS. There is a boat for faithfulness, a boat for abstinence, and a boat for condoms. This is very relevant for the fishermen here, and people really get it. When you explain that this is the way to escape AIDS, a lot of people prefer to stay on the boat for faithfulness because they are married or choose abstinence. Lots of people come to talk to us about things after the workshop. They find us and say, I heard you, and I'm going to do something about this.
Sometimes I leave home in the morning without giving my family any food. When I come here, if I make some money, I send food home to my kids. Poverty is what leads a person to go out and sell herself. When a woman can't make any money, she can sell herself. And when she does that, she can get AIDS. Then the worst happens.
The group knows who's on every street and invites everyone to do their part. Today, their stops include a woodcarver and a barbershop.
The way Dago works is simple. They look at a situation and ask, is there risky behavior here? At a barber's, it's how you use razors. Change blades between customers and don't cut yourself.
Okay, so that's just a taste. somebody hit those lights and can do the window to them. What's the trick, you guys?
Perseverance.
Persevere. Well, it worked the first time. Okay, well, we'll leave it. What struck you about what you saw in that first part, besides that it was greatly dramatized and schnazzy filmmaking?
Practicality.
What's
that? It
was
so practical. Mm-hmm. You don't not talk about it. Mm-hmm. You get out there. You don't lecture about it. Mm-hmm. You offer solutions.
Yeah.
Go to the sites of the risky behavior.
Mm-hmm.
Don't expect people to come to you.
Yeah.
It seemed like the prostitution was established, and maybe not something you could attack because it was a part of the fabric of the community.
Yeah, in a community like that in particular, it's so important.
They mentioned that tourists were the... Would it be tourists from Africa or coming in from European and American countries also?
No, the vast majority of the tourists in that community come from Europe.
Oh.
And secondly, from the United States. And not very many from there would be people from within Senegal.
Yeah.
But probably not very many from other countries in Africa.
So then they're contributing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I was just struck, even though it's a good idea, how few people are actually reading. When you're dealing with a country with 20% HIV,
yeah.
I think the education has to be much more systematic.
Yeah. And that's where I have become pretty critical of Senegal. Yes, they have done some really good stuff like what we saw in this video. And they are reaching individuals, so they are saving lives, probably. But there has not been, it's not in the school system, for example. It is, but it's so minimal, at least at this point. And so they have amazing resources. And the doctor who was briefly interviewed there, and those caseworkers are so skilled and could contribute a lot, but could be doing much more.
Yeah, one prostitute can infect hundreds.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to, they're just not hitting a big enough percentage.
Yeah.
Although actually the transmission from women to men is far, far, far lower than from men to women. So
right.
One HIV positive man who frequents prostitutes regularly is going to infect far more.
And in this video further on, and I think in the community of Mbour, the town where they were, which is a very high-risk geographic area, they do a bit where they talk about how the prostitutes are regularly tested because they're licensed. So one of the things they do in Senegal is licensing. But it shows the case of someone who says that I don't have my license with me because I've kept it at the hospital because I have malaria. And what they've found in that community is that malaria is the code word for HIV. So, and I've found that now in other situations, so not just particularly in that one situation. So I've heard that since with not in a non-prostitute setting. So yeah.
Is that different in Senegal from other African countries? Do you know?
What, the licensing? Oh, yeah. Every country's different. Some people think that's the worst possible thing you could do. So, and there are, you know, there are, it's a mixed bag about whether it is the right thing to do. But, I mean, that is the strategy that Senegal has taken. So.
Is the fact that it's a Muslim country, does that help or hinder education about AIDS?
First, I would qualify that it's that Senegal has its sort of its own forms of Islam,
sure,
which may be very different and may make that the response to that question be different in a different country where it's a different form of Islam. I don't know that it hinders it any more than some of the the primarily Christian African countries, which can be just as prudish and closed about talking about sexuality and, you know, really facing the facts. I don't know that it's any different in the case of Senegal.
So. I don't think that it's different. You can see it in both Christian and Muslim communities. A good way to reach the population is to go through their spiritual leaders. And one of the surprising things we heard from one of our colleagues who attended an international conference in Dakar, which was a conference that grouped Protestant leaders, these are Christians, to talk about this issue, the AIDS issue. He came back and said he was really shocked to see that most of these leaders, they were presidents of churches, priests and pastors, and I mean ministers, they didn't know anything about it, and some of them actually had denied before that day to talk about it in their communities.
So it's not necessarily that there's more openness Muslim in the Christian issue as compared to the Muslim.
Right.
Senegal is a country where they think that the HIV rate is about 1.4% of the population. And it's held up sort of as a model that a lot has been done to keep that low rate. I think they're shooting themselves in the foot. I keep repeating this. Some of you have already heard this. Because they're basically saying to those maybe who don't have a lot of information that the rate is low, so the risk is low. So I'm concerned about that, and I'm concerned about the kind of complacency that can grow from that. And I think they probably have done some really interesting things, including this Lutheran World Relief-supported work that I'm not directly involved with, but that is supported by Lutheran World Relief. There's some really interesting stuff, but they have focused on the high-risk communities, and they have not focused on the really hard-to-reach communities, which are not necessarily a lot lower risk. Mm-hmm. In particular, in our rural area, there's so much now migration, particularly men who will leave their families behind and will go to another country to find work, to make money, to support their families, to take another wife, you know, the whole deal. They go, though, and live in another country and probably have a, a girlfriend or take another wife in that place may not use protection. The same thing, their spouse is at home, their husband's gone for 3 years, 4 years. They might also have sexual relations outside of their marriage. There are some really high risk factors in our communities, but it's this dispersed rural, you know, living on farms or little tiny villages that are being affected, and that's one area that I see. Things are gonna take hold, but it's not gonna be the huge numbers because the majority of the population is still in the urban centers. So at the same time, even many of those young girls who are sex workers in Boer are young girls that we might know from our community whose families, because there was such poor harvest last year and because there's no employment in our community or because they never got to go to school, they go to the cities to look for work as house workers. But I think they oftentimes end up in situations that they're house workers, but they're abused, or they're also selling their bodies in order to help provide for their families at home. So there's a whole, you know, there's all of these different situations, and that not enough is still being done. A story, and our community, like I said, the community health work that we've been involved in has tried to address HIV/AIDS, but along with all of the other issues of health in the communities. I've been working a lot with the head doctor, the district health doctor in our community, and the head social worker and some other community folks to make some more concerted efforts. One of the problems when you do education about HIV is you tell people that you can't, how do you know that you are HIV positive? Do you guys know? How do you know if you're HIV positive?
Blood test.
Yeah, blood test. Can you do that blood test on any street corner?
No.
Yeah, and we're talking about a situation where for the longest time you would have had to go all the way to the capital city. Well, now it is available at a hospital which is about a 2-hour drive from our town, but then that much further from the rural communities where we serve. One of the keys to prevention is it through education, people understand whether they might be at risk, but the way for them to determine whether they are HIV positive is by having a test. And so we're trying to make that more accessible. There are negotiations now. What we're doing is at least the doctor at our local hospital can take blood samples and she can send it down the road to the hospital, and they've made an arrangement for that finally to start working. And she'd done about 5 cases, I think, by the time I left. But our hope is that the testing will be available in our own hospital. We're a hospital that doesn't have an operating block, doesn't do blood transfusions or any of that. So all of those kinds of cases get evacuated to that other hospital anyway. So it's not as though, you know, there's also that risk going on. But so that's just one of the challenges we're dealing with.
Is there any hope for the saliva test?
I don't know. The real complicated aspect to all of that is even working with the head doctor who works for the Ministry of Health, it's so hard to find out what national policy is. And Senegal has actually was the place where it was determined that there was HIV-2, mm-hmm. was done by a professor in Senegal. And that whole, there's a clinic that holds on so tightly with good reasons for epidemiological study and everything else to how things are done, that it's hard to know what you're allowed to do and what you're not allowed to do, and it's a central control issue. So hopefully, and that would maybe be the best the best hope for our community.
If it's close to FDA approval here, we get everything last through the FDA.
Yeah, so it's probably available.
Yeah, you'd think.
But so that's one of the issues we work on. The nurse midwife who I followed in my position had, in providing care to people in one of the villages where we work, asked a few people to go to this distant hospital to be tested. And that was about 5 years ago, and she left about 3 years. No, that was about 5 years ago, and she left about 4 years ago. So the initial reaction of those people who actually were HIV positive was denial. And they did nothing, and then she left. And so they were abandoned because there wasn't any other structure put in place. But the health worker, the village health worker in that community, he had not been told the results of the test. But he was suspecting, just because he's well-trained, also he saw that these two neighbors of his were often sick, that it had just been a continuing cycle, that there wasn't much care that could really help them. So he turned to me, and I said, well, and he said he knew they'd had tests, but he didn't know whether they were positive or negative. So I went to the doctor and said, I bet you have the records of these tests. And she said she did. And then if they came in, if we could convince them to come in and we could do again the counseling with them, maybe we could get them to accept their diagnosis. And one of the things that pushed her to have the courage to do it, because this is a new doctor who's really got basically no experience in this area. She's had trainings and counseling and stuff. One of the things I think that encouraged her to take that risk, because it's not an easy thing to do, was the possibility that they would get antiretrovirals. There is a program, it's still centralized, so it's all based in the capital city. But we spoke with these two individuals. They accepted, they believed, they understood. I think that they'd had the time, there was the time to let the information sink in. At the same time, they had their illiterate Pular people who live in a village who have access to very little information, maybe the occasional spot on the radio, something. So they're now enrolled in the national program and on ARVs. One was just starting when I left. So, but it's just to show sort of the complexity of the situation. Even health workers have for so long seen it as such a despairing situation that they're oftentimes not even ready to confront it. Or they may well recognize risk factors in someone that they treat, but they, even though legally they're required to talk about HIV, for example, if there's a sexually transmitted disease, they don't do it because they were sort of like, you don't know what's going to happen next. So, yeah.
Yeah. So AIDS primarily is a heterosexual transmission.
Yeah, primarily.
Mm-hmm. But in this country, it's needles and heterosexual activity.
Mm-hmm. Is what it seems like, at least. And there are debates about that, too. A couple months ago, there was some research had been looked at again, and there's an argument that, in fact, there are still a huge percentage of the cases are through medical instruments, needles that are being reused and stuff like that. But it sort of blew up, but there's still an ongoing debate about the prevalence of those kinds of transmissions, too.
Willie, could you talk a little bit more about what you were saying about how the spiritual leaders, that their ability to influence, could you just kind of expand on that a little bit?
If you take the case of Islam in Senegal, they have brotherhood, Islamic brotherhood in the
They're sort of
system,
like denominations.
Like denominations.
Okay.
Yeah, and each of these ones have a spiritual leader. And people owe some respect to these spiritual leaders. And annually they will organize prayer sessions, and they go to a specific place where this leader is, and they will pray and they will offer whatever they want to offer. And it is during these sessions that some of the information can be passed on. And the spiritual leaders have a lot of even political power. Mm-hmm. So they can, what they say is somehow really the truth, always truth.
So do you think they're comfortable speaking of, so specifically about sexual behavior?
That's where the problem is.
Yeah.
If they were comfortable talking about it, then they would serve as very good channels. Mm-hmm. But this is really, regrettably, not the case. Mm-hmm. So, and it's the same with Christianity, because in Africa, when you are in a certain position of leadership, you assume the responsibility of father of all, mm-hmm. or mother of all. Mm-hmm. You're a queen or a king. So and so people tend to listen very much to you, just like they listen to their parent. And so in the past and even in the present, these channels have been used to pass on some kinds of information. So if these people were open and willing to talk about these things, then it would be very good. And that would be very helpful to send out the message.
Part of the reason I asked that or talk about that is, you know, I read a study a couple years ago that was done in the United States about premarital sexual behavior and looking at kids, and it was surprising to find out how many youth were uncertain about their parents' value about being involved in that or not, and that when a parent speaks from their heart about what it is they value, that was probably one of the biggest determinants in someone choosing not to have mm-hmm. premarital sex. Mm-hmm. And what I was left with was how that we don't speak to our values, and if we don't speak to our values, it's very difficult for us to influence behavior, because, you know, it was like these youth didn't know, they were surprised that their parents cared that much that they abstained, type of thing. And it was, you know, kind of surprising to the kids and the adults.
Or why?
Right.
The why behind it.
But just that whole sense of that it's value.
Don't do it.
Right. But that you value it. And so again, that's where I see the spiritual leaders, maybe if they can get to the point of really speaking to a value and explaining why, that may help, you know, tremendous influence.
Yeah. I think at the same time, a lot of activities that are, or programs that are organized around these issues, sometimes realize that it's going to be real hard to get those religious leaders to change their way of talking. But if you can at least get them to encourage people to let their children, for example, be involved in programs that talk about family life, that gives the stamp of approval from that spiritual leader for certain activities, which do then, you know, try to deal with the issues of sexuality. And, you know, if the approval is there, it seems like that makes a lot of difference already. So, because to turn somebody around and make them comfortable, I mean, it's huge amounts of preparation and training, and sometimes it's not going to happen. So, yeah.
I heard it too about a successful church-related program in Seattle that the youth groups, that the leaders for them were very committed to whatever the questions were about sexuality, that they would give scientific, truthful answers. That was like the full bottom line for this, no matter how it influenced what they wanted to say or how they wanted to influence their kids. And that having established that level of truthful speaking brought not only the church from that, the youth from that church together, but it was impressive for their peers to hear that these teenagers were saying, "You're talking about that at your church?" Yeah. And so, you know, that there had been a big inroad into, you know, being able to influence a lot of youth, but it was just really that standard of, I'm not going to get the you know, the propaganda, that they were committed to saying, whatever we say will be the truth.
Yeah. So I think we have, after having worked in the Central African Republic, where the majority of the population is Christian and are members of churches, and then being in a community that is about 99% Muslim, has really changed how I need to think about working. Part of it is just organizationally. There aren't necessarily the same kind of traditional style youth groups that you can meet with or work with. The church in the Central African Republic, as were many, was probably too slow in responding. But CAR is also blessed with an association of all the medical organizations of the Christian churches. And that organization is now taking some really great steps. We can all say it's too late, but better late than never, in my opinion. So we've seen too many people die, and the suffering and the everything that goes along with that. But hopefully now things can start to turn around, although CAR is just in shambles politically and economically. So there, like I said, I worked with this project that was formed out of a commission of the church that prepared really the first educational materials about HIV/AIDS in Sango, which is the national language. And we did that in 95. So you're talking about quite a long delay. And despite the fact that the government had its national program fighting AIDS since who knows when, they had not prepared any materials in the national language, which the majority of people are able to read. So, and we also work a lot with what, and maybe some of you have seen that before, the boat image. I don't know if that's used in the U.S. too, is it?
No,
the three boats. It's a really great, actually I think it's a model that comes from France. The boat of abstinence, the boat of fidelity, and the boat of protection, which refers mainly to condoms, using condoms. So that has really served as a great teaching tool. CAR is not as fortunate as Senegal. It doesn't have the access to the antiretrovirals in such huge numbers, although I've seen news the past few months that some programs are going to start. But our stories from there are more the kinds of stories that other people have been telling this week, even from their experiences in Tanzania and other parts of the continent. CAR probably has an HIV rate of close to 20%. So even since we've left there 2.5 years ago, we've learned of the death of, I don't know how many people. One in particular was the assistant director of the health center where I was working. And it was, in his case, a huge case of denial as well. Mm. And there, you're talking about somebody who'd worked in health for 20 years or so. And the situation in that community, too, is one that, though that population is Christian, there is still a very strong belief in witchcraft. And so his also, he was probably a third-generation Christian. His family accused his wife of killing him. His wife also is sick. We haven't heard, there's been conflict there since October, so we have no news from that community since then. But she was forced to move back with her family. Most likely all of the children were taken from her. Their youngest child was like 2 when we were there. She actually seemed pretty healthy. when we left, so I pray that she actually made it out of there without HIV. But it's going to be another one of these situations where either aunts and uncles will care for children or grandparents. It's a continuing saga. The experiences are real to many of us. Some of it just sounds unreal.
Is it like pretty much always fatal in Africa, or is there treatment?
Well, the antiretrovirals extend a person's life if they get them at the right time, when it's not too late. But they're not a cure, so there is no cure. It's just to improve their immune system so that they can fight off the other diseases, which are plentiful.
Is it readily available?
No, it's not, and that's one of the major issues. So, and it, sort of an aside but related to what we're talking about, people often ask this, or especially me when I come back to the States, about the reverse culture shock and what I noticed that's changed. And we hadn't been here since 9/11, so you can imagine some of that stuff. But the other thing that I've noticed is the drug ads on TV.
Mm-hmm.
That were never like that before.
Mm-hmm.
And it just makes me sick, because that's why people are dying instead of living longer lives, when they would be able to care for their children and raise their children and share their values. So,
do you say that because of the money spent?
Yeah.
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 On the newest, fanciest
On the newest, fanciest
brand.
Thing that you're supposed to go ask your doctor to prescribe
right.
for
yeah.
you. So, and I heard something on the news the other day that I think it was Pfizer has a bigger marketing budget than Nike.
Yeah.
Wow.
And it's just inconceivable.
If you hear Dr. Coles,
yeah.
he's talking about drug companies.
Yeah, he's mentioned that a lot.
Well, you know, it's the people, too.
Yeah.
I'm a doctor, and I'll say, well, I'm going to, you know, we'll start you on this. It's generic. It's
mm-hmm.
tried and true. And it'll cost you a lot less. They say, oh, no, I only pay $10.
Right.
And it's like, well, you know, we're all paying, you know.
Yeah.
Just because it's only $10 when you get the medicine,
yeah.
it's your premium, it's our
yeah.
healthcare dollars as a society. And
yeah.
that mentality of, I saw it on TV and I'm going to have it, I only pay $10 no matter what.
Yeah.
It's
so,
really consumer driven.
Yeah, it really is. Just like in our communities, in some of our areas, in the village health huts, you know, you've got people in the village saying, well, why can't the village health worker have Bactrim? Which is an antibiotic which that health worker isn't trained to know how to use. But, you know, everybody thinks Bactrim is the wonder cure, and maybe there's not the billboards up about it, but it's still the consumer driven. And so sometimes the health workers break down and find an illegal source of Bactrim and are selling it and not using it correctly. And it's all of us who are going to suffer from it. So it's it's a lot, and then we try to fight it with information, which is the same thing here. I mean, there are campaigns to teach people about generics, but, you know, we hear what we want to hear, and we throw out the rest. So, yeah. So, this video comes with a little warning on it that you better watch it before you show it to your audience. And it says, especially if they're under the age of 14, it gets to be even more out there, showing a guy carving a wooden penis, which is used for showing people how to use condoms. And that the church is involved in that kind of work, because, and it's something controversial that we've had to deal with. Even in CAR, we would speak at conferences or women's gatherings, and you get these, some of the pastors' wives would get up and say, we can't teach our kids about condoms, they're gonna become promiscuous and all that kind of stuff. And others would get up and say, well, if we don't, they're gonna die. So, you know, And it's been, it's in, especially when you're working among the Christian organizations, and I think also with the Muslim groups, it's an issue of contention.
Yeah.
How do we teach about that boat, the protection boat? And most of the Lutherans, what they come down on is it's a broken creation and we are sinners, but let us not seek death, and may we find ways to protect others even in our sin. So sort of, and so the video really gets into some more of that. My parents were shocked by the video. Not horribly shocked, but somewhat shocked, and knew that it would be only appropriate for certain audiences. But I think it is really actually quite good, and is a good video for starting conversation in our churches with youth groups. I think with kids below 14 as well as above 14, although with very guided and clear statements of our values, but where we're coming from in response to this crisis. So.
Is there less negative reaction to that in Senegal than here? Because, I mean, are the people in your area so aware of problem?
No, they're not.
AIDS that they need? So they still, they would react negatively to this too, in terms of seeing a condom as an invitation to act out your sexuality rather than a protection.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So
people,
they would react the same.
People would still react in that way. So
most people
were still reacting that way, and in most African families, it's really difficult for parents to talk about sex with their kids.
Sounds familiar.
Yeah. Even at my age, it's difficult for my parents to talk to me about it. They know that I know.
Yeah.
They know that the kids are doing it, but it's never been in their culture or in their habit to talk about it, which is a very difficult obstacle when you have to deal with this issue, and that's why people stand up and talk.
So that would be no matter what religion,
right?
Muslim or Christian.
Yeah, no matter what.
Yeah.
And it gets even more complicated with Islam. For example, Christians working with youth groups and trying to work with Muslim kids. So that's what Anne was talking about, the stamp of the parents. So you need
the stamp and the stamp of the religious leaders.
You have to go to convince the parent to allow their child to come to listen to these Christians.
Which is only correct.
So you have the first barrier, which is traditional, and then the Christian barrier, which is sitting there.
Yeah.
To go
some of that.
So it makes the work pretty difficult.
It seems like if you focused on those religious leaders to give that stamp of approval, then the parent stamp of approval would come much more easily.
Yeah,
it does.
Often.
Mm-hmm.
So that is what is really key.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you had.
This is so terribly discouraging. I think that. We had a Namibian student live with us for 4 years, and when she went back to Namibia, the last time I visited her was 1996. Her community at that time was 8% HIV positive.
Mm-hmm.
It's now over 20.
Yeah, it's like the Central
so
African.
What's happening here, I mean, people are worried about showing coatings of penises and condoms.
Yeah.
But we're talking about a continent where the latent period of this virus is such that it's just going to continue to explode.
Yeah, that's right.
And the whole doggone continent's going to die. And the country's governments cannot afford the health care for these people. People are mad about not having enough
access to
antiviral therapy, and yet even in our country, where antiviral therapy is available,
people don't have access.
Begin to relax. It becomes an excuse to not worry about it anymore. This has been shown in our gay community. It's scary. I think the only way this is going to play out, actually. I mean, I feel about as hopeless about this as anything I've ever felt medically. I think the only way this is going to probably play out is that so many people are going to die that people are going to be afraid to have sex with anybody except their spouse again. And that's probably going to take another 10 or 20 years, mm-hmm. when half the continent's going to be dead.
And I think that's already happening in some places like Uganda, yeah. which actually had hit a max level where that kind of behavior change now came about.
Right.
And most things say that you only will change your behavior, and not you won't necessarily do that. I mean, what I've learned is when you know someone else who is HIV positive or who is dying from AIDS or has died from AIDS. But even that doesn't change it necessarily. But it's, I mean, you have to hit that huge plateau.
Do you know what the rates were in Uganda when it was as bad as it got and mm-hmm. people changed their behavior? You wonder.
I think it was like, it must have been around 15 or 20% uh-huh. at that point. I would imagine, which is what it is in like South Africa right now. So
what do you attribute a slower development of this in Senegal? Is it just the time hasn't come yet and it will, or is there something
so.
About that culture that's different?
No, there, I don't think there is.
I think,
from what we see.
I think one of the problems is this centralized, guided kind of approaches that people take. Now, the Senegalese government has a program which receives this antiretroviral drug, and this is supposed to go out to patients. And what is happening is the program is so centralized, only in Dakar, and only in one hospital where you can go to have all these things. So even like if we were working out in Lingam, we didn't know that this program exists. Those people will never get there. And even now that they know, we have to provide them the transport even to go there. And they have to go to Dakar 6 hours away. That is from our town. They come out of the village 2 hours, come up to our town. They're going to take 6 hours to go to Dakar. They don't have where to stay, they don't have where to eat, to get drugs. And they have to go there like 2 times every month.
Not 2 times every month.
Yeah, that's what it could be.
At the beginning.
At the beginning.
And once every 2 months.
Yeah.
So 6 times a year.
Okay. Mm-hmm. 6 times a year. This guy, if he has to try to get money now to be able to travel, there's nobody supporting him. Yeah. It becomes really, you start to question, why are these drugs even there? Because if they cannot be available to the people, why do you?
Well, the fact of the matter is there's not a huge quantity available.
Mm-hmm.
And that sort of answers your question too, are they available? They're... If you look at like the 1.5% of Senegalese who are HIV positive, of which who knows which tiny percentage knows even that they are HIV positive, the 1.5% would probably be about 80,000 people. And there are 1,500 people getting ARVs. So they also only give it when you're at a certain stage with the disease. But yeah, it's a lot of hoops to jump through. And
yeah, and when you look at Senegal, the work they have done so far, but still, this testing is not available
mm-hmm.
in a big town like India. So there's still a lot of work in the level of the government and the level of institutions that are willing to provide this system.
So I'm about where you are on this.
Yeah, and then we're not even talking about tuberculosis.
And
the other burdens that these countries have on malaria. But refractory tuberculosis in these patients is deadly and extremely expensive to treat.
Mm-hmm.
And
complicated to treat. I mean, because
you
put people on drugs, they take it for a few weeks, a couple months, they feel better, they quit taking it.
Right.
So it's an incredibly complicated disease to deal with as well. So, yeah, it's a real. So should we quit doing what we're doing? I mean, should we just let it pay?
I mean, what can we do?
Take the drug companies seem to be, I mean, it's like, what can we do even to...
Well, maybe the doctors can give us ideas.
Get them to share more, or...
Oh, they're sharing.
Not advertise so highly to us.
Yeah.
Of course, Americans, they just want the best right now.
Yeah.
Immediately. Okay, for you.
What about the availability of condoms? Is that,
yeah,
is that everywhere free, or is it?
Yeah, that's always a, there's always an issue of distribution.
Yeah.
They're available and they're free through the program that fights sexually transmitted diseases.
But then getting it to the villages.
But they don't get into all the villages, and there's not necessarily a structure at the village level that would be responsible for distribution.
And the religious leaders aren't handing them out.
Well, in fact, in one of our health huts, the person who was responsible for the condoms was a religious leader, which is difficult too.
Right.
At least they're available, but not every adolescent is going to dare go up to the
So for sure.
So they're made out of
something
never. So.
You know, as a physician, I think it sounds terrible to say, but I feel rather pragmatic about it, just as it's probably not reasonable to expect the religious leaders to start talking about sexual behavior and the risk, it's probably not reasonable to think that we're going to get antiretrovirals to all the HIV-positive people in Africa, and that with what resources there are, the best stewardship would be towards prevention. And
and care.
And care.
Other aspects of care.
Other aspects of care.
Yeah.
To lift these women out of poverty so they're not faced with the choice of prostitution or watching their children starve to death.
Yeah.
And to provide the condoms, make sure they're just easily and readily available for those who are in prostitution or for those who choose not to be on the boats of abstinence or faithfulness.
Right.
That could prevent massive suffering if it could be implemented on a large scale.
Yeah.
And
I think that's true too, and I struggle sometimes, as much as I also want to be on the boat of fighting so that everybody can get the ARVs, I'm more on the pragmatic side saying, but let us not forget that we have a heck of a lot of work to do to care for those who are never going to get access to that. And I would be shot down by some people saying, well, no, you should be working for the absolutely best scenario. Well, yeah, you can do that, and in the process a lot of people are dying miserable deaths instead of being cared for until they die in a better way.
Yeah.
I mean, so...
And the reality
is... And Senegal
is
a really... is I struggle with that, particularly in Senegal, because here they are, they think they're so ahead of everything, and that they're, because their rates are low, maybe they're going to get ARVs for everybody. But the reality to me is we need to start thinking about other kind of care provision. But most people, because this is sort of the beginning of their dealing with it, they're jumping into the bath when the ARVs are already there, so they focus so much on that and neglect the other strategies that need to be followed. So it's really a challenge, and I don't know how some folks can get reoriented. So, how are we doing on time? We're up, aren't we?
Yeah.
So, thanks.
Thank you.
Do as much as you can. The Stand With Africa campaign is providing some ideas of how church groups and individuals can be involved. It is a very hopeless situation, but I keep repeating, as a friend says, we are an Easter people.
Yeah.
So,
thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you.